Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, November 2nd. Lights are going off, except for that back one over there. Really good. Let's take a look at the schedule. As a matter of fact, I have all the lectures that I have uploaded already. If you're missing a lecture, then it's lost. But I think I have, for this class, all the lectures up there, ready to listen to. So the second, we're going to start endocrine system today after we finish a couple things in special senses. There's practicums this week. And let's see, that's 7, 8, and 10. Lab 7, 8, and 10. Eyeball dissection, and then the rest are models of eye, ear, and muscles. And then we're going to start the heart. The heart chapter is not on the next test. So endocrine system is the last chapter for the next test, which is going to be November 16th. That's a Monday. So what is that? Two weeks away, exactly. All right, then you all have the study guides, and you know what to study for that exam. Anybody have a question? You all are good. Okay. Well, let's put the schedule away, and let's see where we are. Okay, here. Okay, where did we leave off last time? Who's got a sense of where we left off? I don't think we've got into the ear. Did we get into the ear? Extrinsic eye muscles. Oh, okay. Okay, so still some accessory structures of the eye. And oh, here we are. Okay. All right, well, let's take a look at an eye. We'll put this up over here. And, okay, you remember the extrinsic eye muscles. Unless you have a question, I won't go over those again. Anybody have a question on those? They're just skeletal muscles. They're just the way that your eyeball can put the light that you want to focus on the very special part of the retina, which is called the fovea centralis or macula lutea. That gives you your best vision. All right, so let's look at some layers of the eye first. Here's a nice transverse section. And there are three main layers that you have to know about. The outermost layer is the sclera. That's the toughest one, and that looks white. So that's really easy to see, and even when you did your dissection, that was an area that was really easy to see because it's so white. All right. Then when you cut the eye open, right, you made a circular incision just posterior to the cornea, which is right here. The cornea actually is part of the sclera, but it's been modified so that it's clear, and that modification also makes it a lot weaker as well, right? The white part of the sclera is very tough and strong, but the cornea is delicate and weak. Okay, so that's the sclera. The next deepest layer is the choroid. And the choroid in your dissection was black. Maybe it looked a little blue or purple. What was that color in there? Was it blue or purple or what? A bunch of different colors. I think I heard turquoise even. But it was kind of shiny. Okay, and that's the layer that contains blood vessels. Then the deepest layer is the retina that I see right here. That contains photoreceptor cells. That's what is responsible for vision. There are no blood vessels in the retina. Blood vessels should be in the choroid. If blood vessels grow up into the retina, then that pushes aside the photoreceptor cells, and you have a blind spot as a result of that. Did I talk to you about premature babies last time? Yeah? No? Who remembers? No. Ah, okay. All right, so those are the layers. And these blood vessels shouldn't grow up into the retina. When there is a premature baby and they have trouble breathing and regulating body temperature, what do we typically do for them to help them breathe, help them regulate body temperature? Where do we put them? In an incubator, that's right. And the way we help them breathe is by increasing the concentration of oxygen inside that incubator, so that it's easier for oxygen to diffuse into their bodies. Even though their lung function isn't mature, right, that oxygen still has a greater ability to enter their body. So oxygen dissolves, right, into their eye and moves all the way to the retina, diffuses through the retina and into the choroid. And that stimulates these blood vessels to grow into the retina because that's where the oxygen is coming from. Right? And when that happens, when the infant grows up, then they'll have a vision deficit. They'll have a retinopathy. And so that's called retinopathy of prematurity. All right, so when somebody's in an incubator, then you have to be very careful of increasing the oxygen concentration. You want to help the infant as much as possible, but you don't want to set them up for blindness later on in life. All right, so what layer should blood vessels be in? The choroid, that's right, not the retina. All right, so those are the layers. There are a couple chambers in the eye, okay, and what we're looking at right here is what we call the posterior segment. So it's a chamber or a cavity, and it's filled with material that's like jelly, and we call that vitreous humor. And it kind of came out, most of you guys when you did a dissection found some gooey stuff attached to the lens over here. It came out when we took the lens off. That's vitreous humor that's contained in the posterior segment. Right, there's also an anterior segment. Here is the lens. That's the line that separates the posterior segment from the anterior segment. And in the anterior segment, that contains aqueous humor. Aqueous humor is like water. It runs just like water, as opposed to vitreous humor. It doesn't run at all. And there are actually two cavities within this anterior segment. Here is the iris. Right, and the iris is a muscle that can dilate the pupil or constrict the pupil depending on light conditions. The pupil is constricted when it's very bright light out, but right now all of our pupils are dilated because we're in a dark room. Right, and as the pupil gets bigger, more light can enter the eye. So anterior to the iris, that's the colored part of our eye, right, is a part of that anterior segment, and sometimes we call this the anterior cavity of the anterior segment, right? And then behind the iris, but before you get to the lens, this is what we call the posterior cavity of the anterior segment, right? So these things do definitely have different names. They're filled with aqueous humor, and that helps them operate. All right, so the iris is moving all day long, depending on light conditions. It's contracting, it's dilating the pupil. Right, there's something else that's changing all day long, and that is the lens. Right, the job of the lens is to focus light at a precise point, okay, right here on the fovea centralis, or generally in this area called the macula lutea. And it just so happens that when light approaches your eye or hits your eye from far away, the light rays are almost parallel. And so they don't need to be bent quite as much to focus on this part of the retina. But if light is close to you, then it is moving away from you in all directions. Right? It has a much greater angularity to it. So it takes more curvature of this lens to focus light since it's bending away from your eye very sharply. All right, so these curved surfaces help bend light to focus over here. So the lens has to change shape. If light is coming from very close to you, then this lens has to have a lot of curvature and it gets thick. When light is coming far away from you, then this lens needs to get thinner, right, and more flat. So let's just do an experiment. Take your hand and stick it way out in front of you. Okay, and concentrate on your fingernails. Just really, really concentrate on your fingernails. And what can you tell me about the background when you concentrate on your fingernails? Is it in focus? No, it's not. Okay, keep your finger there. Now, focus on the background, but keep your fingernails in your field of view. What happened to your fingernails? They're blurry. That's right. So you can only focus at one distance from your eye at a time. Right? So you don't have continuous focus with that. Okay, so that's the job of the lens. It changes shape. The muscle that pulls on the lens is the ciliary body. And it's a circular smooth muscle. We just see it in cross-section here. And then there are some ligaments that attach the ciliary body or ciliary muscle to the lens. And these are the suspensory ligaments here. All right, so the lens is changing shape all day long. The iris is changing shape all day long. And that leads me to a short discussion on the importance of this aqueous humor in the anterior segment of the eye. All right, we said the cornea is clear, but it's very delicate. It's easy to damage. It's easy to perforate. Right? If some sharp object hits your eye and you're not wearing glasses or safety glasses, it's going to put a hole in the cornea. And that aqueous humor is just going to dribble right out. It's going to run right out. And so now you don't have aqueous humor between the iris and the cornea. You don't have aqueous humor between the iris and the lens, and they touch each other. Right? And here's the bad part. No one has figured out a way how to unstick these structures when they touch. Right? When they touch, they get stuck together, and they're just stuck together forever. All right, so what about the iris? Can it change shape if it's glued to the cornea? It can't change shape anymore, right? What about if the lens, right, gets stuck or glued to the iris? Can the lens change shape anymore? It can't, right? So this eye is going to have severe vision deficits because it can't accommodate for distance, and it can't adjust for different light conditions. And also the cornea right here is also acting like a lens. Right, it has the same kind of shape as the lens right here that helps bend light. And as a matter of fact, the cornea is even more important for overall focusing power compared to the lens. And when these things get stuck together, then the focusing power of the cornea is disturbed as well. So that eye is really messed up. And that's kind of the reason why I like to wear glasses. When I ride a motorcycle, build stuff in a garage, rip a house apart or something, it's good to have eye protection on. So your cornea isn't damaged. There are also pain receptors in the cornea. And if the cornea is damaged, I've been told, fortunately I haven't experienced this, that the pain you feel is the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. And so there's really no reason for anybody to go through that, right? So wear safety goggles, no matter what lab you're in, physics lab, chemistry lab, anatomy lab, it's always good to have those safety glasses on. All right, so those are the three layers, something about the different compartments and the fluids inside the eye, right? And the retina has the photoreceptor cells that send electrical signals to the brain via the optic nerve. And the optic nerve attaches to the retina, right? And where it attaches to the retina, there are no photoreceptor cells. And we call that the optic disc. And since there are no photoreceptors there, functionally it is a blind spot in your vision. You have a blind spot in one eye and a blind spot in the other. But when we look around the room, we don't really see that blind spot anymore because our brain just wipes it out. It puts information that we think should be there, and it gets information from the other eye. And that's kind of interesting. In lab, I'll put a diagram on the board so you can actually see something disappear if you just follow this little technique, and you'll be able to actually visualize your blind spot. All right, the photoreceptor cells in the retina. There are two kinds. There are rods and cones. And in the macula lutea, and especially the fovea centralis, they're loaded with cone cells. Cone cells are a little bit smaller. Right? Cone cells can give you color vision and really high resolution or sharp vision, color and sharp vision. Right? And that's why those extrinsic eye muscles like to take light and move the eyeball around so light goes right back over to here, right back to the macula lutea. That's your best vision from rod cells. Right? The downside of those rod cells is that they need bright light in order to function. So right now you have really poor color vision because it's kind of dark in here, even though you're using those cone cells. Right, and if we turn the lights down even more, then your color vision would pretty much disappear. You still might be able to recognize some objects, and that's because of the rod cells. The rod cells, right, are in your peripheral vision. So only cone cells in the fovea centralis, and as you move away more to the periphery, there are fewer and fewer cone cells and more rod cells. Okay, so rod cells work in dim light. That's really nice. But they're bigger, and so your vision is not as sharp with your peripheral vision. It's a little bit blurry. There's just no way to focus light. And also, those rod cells only give you things in black and white or gray, actually grayscale. You don't have any color vision in your peripheral vision. It's just grayscale. So those are the two kinds of cells, rod cells, cone cells, and the trade-off between them. Okay, so that's the eye. Anybody have a question on the eye? Structure of the eye? All right, so don't forget, this is on the practicum. Okay, the real cow eye, and maybe even some models. Okay, the ear. And the ear has, let's take a look at overall structure of the ear. It has three main compartments or components to it. So here's a pretty good illustration of an ear. Maybe this area here is enlarged just a little bit, right? So it's not drawn perfectly to scale, but not too bad. So there is an external ear that goes from your auricle, this flap of cartilage and skin, okay, that helps focus sound energy into this canal, and the external acoustic canal, and we call that a meatus. These things make up the external ear, and that's necessary for hearing, right? Sound waves need to enter the temporal bone. They bump into a membrane right here, and this is what we call the tympanic membrane. Sound is a pressure wave, and that pressure wave vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth. Right, so it's not like a light wave, it's a pressure wave. And when the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, it vibrates these three tiny little bones. And these bones are what we call auditory ossicles. And as a matter of fact, if I had all three of them between my fingertips right now, and I said, I've got all three between my fingertips, you could say, oh no, you don't, because I don't see them. But they're so small, they would fit between my fingertips just like that. So they are really small. And here is the incus, and it sits right on top of the tympanic membrane. That's the one doctors can see when they look inside your ear, if you don't have an infection in this part of the ear. And then, this is the malleus. And then the incus is in the middle, and then the stapes, because it looks like a stirrup that you use to ride a horse with. All right, so these auditory ossicles are in a place we call the middle ear. And there shouldn't be a pressure difference between the middle ear and this external acoustic meatus, right, because that would push the tympanic membrane one way or the other. So let's just say that there is high pressure in this external acoustic meatus and low in the middle ear. That would push the tympanic membrane all the way into the middle ear and hold it there, and it couldn't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, can you hear anything? You cannot. It's got to vibrate in order for you to hear something. So there's something that equalizes the pressure on either side of that tympanic membrane, and that is the auditory tube. You could call it that. You could call it Eustachian tube. You could call it pharyngotympanic tube, and in a couple of weeks you'll understand something about the pharynx, but this is a tube that goes to your throat, which helps equalize pressure on either side of this tympanic membrane so that it can vibrate back and forth really nice. All right, so that's the middle ear connected with your throat. Sometimes when you have a sore throat, which we call pharyngitis, that infection moves up into the middle ear, especially youngsters, that happens with a lot, and they call that otitis. Right, otitis, otic for ear, media, meaning the middle ear is infected, otitis media. Okay, sometimes it's hard to clear up because antibiotics can't get in this region because there are no blood vessels. All right, then we go into the inner ear. And so these auditory ossicles are vibrating, including the stapes. And if you look at the footprint of the stapes right here, does that look like a square to you? Does it look like a triangle? Does it look like a circle? Somebody told me an oval. Thank you. I was running out of things to say. It is an oval, right? And so there is a membrane underneath the foot right here of the stapes, and it's called a window, and it's named after its shape. So that's the oval window. So oval window enters this little tiny bony structure inside the petrous region of the temporal bone. Remember petrous region where it was? Between the internal and external acoustic meatus. All right, so here is the oval window, sound enters. And this right here is what we call a labyrinth because there are a number of chambers that make it up. And there are actually three, and I'll show you where these are on a next slide, but I'll mention them right now. This thing that looks like a snail, that's what we call the cochlea, that's for hearing. There is a bulge right here, we call that the vestibule. That's important for a form of equilibrium so that you maintain your balance when you're moving. We call that static equilibrium from the vestibule. And then you see these things kind of look circular. There are actually three of them. I see two on this slide, and they're called semicircular canals. These also give you a sense of equilibrium. right? But a different kind. This one works when you're spinning, right? The one over here, the static equilibrium, is only for linear acceleration when you're moving forwards and backwards. But the semicircular canals can actually tell your cerebellum when you start to spin or when you stop spinning, right? So that's the big difference between these. All right, so you see the external ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. Inner ear contains these bony structures that we call the bony labyrinth of the inner ear. All right. There's a nice oval window. There is a nerve that takes information from the cochlea, right, and the vestibule. So here's that vestibule, and it's called what? The vestibulocochlear nerve. Vestibulocochlear nerve. Right, that's in your lab list, and I think you ran into that when we looked at peripheral nerves. It used to be called the auditory nerve. That's why in that mnemonic there's an A right there instead of a B. But so they simplified it a little bit so it makes more sense because it's connected to the vestibule and the cochlea. Right, so it's for equilibrium and hearing, both of those senses. Okay. There are some muscles in the inner ear, in the middle ear, that can dampen the vibrations of these auditory ossicles if sound gets too loud, because then that could damage the cochlea. All right, so here I see the tensor tympani muscle. There's also a stapedius muscle right over here, right? And that kind of holds these auditory ossicles in position so they don't vibrate too much when sound is really, really loud. Okay. Now, where do we find, what part of the ear do we find this stapedius muscle? Is it external, middle, or internal ear? That's the middle ear. Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about, the middle ear. Okay, inside that bony labyrinth, there's a membranous labyrinth. All right, so we've broken through the bone, and we're looking at some membranes. We said the cochlea is responsible for hearing. And it's all rolled up like this. It doesn't need to be rolled up, but it's really a nice feature because the way that hearing works is that it works like a piano, right? And one part of the cochlea is responsible for high-frequency sounds, and the exact opposite end is responsible for you to hear low-frequency sounds. And in the middle, sort of like mid-range frequency sounds, just like a piano, right? And that has a shape kind of like a piano, and are all the strings inside the piano the same length, same diameter? You know what? The low notes are a lot longer strings, and they're thicker. The strings that hit a very high note are very short and thin. So just by the size of the strings, right, the frequency that you hear or the pitch that you hear will be different. The same thing for the cochlea. All right, so sound enters this oval window, goes around through the cochlea, and then you can hear it, right? If it was just a straight keyboard like a piano, then these cochlea would be sticking out the side of your head. You'd have piano sticking out either side of your head. So evolution has figured out a way to roll up that keyboard so it fits into a really small space, right? Like that petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay, if we look inside the cochlea, okay, we can see some chambers. And basically, there are three chambers. Let's look at this one. There's one on the top, one in the middle, and one here on the bottom. They have different names, right? This one here on the bottom is called the cochlear duct, and the one on the top is the vestibular canal, and that is connected to the oval window. The one on the bottom is called the tympanic canal. And sound enters the oval window and goes through the cochlear duct, exciting some sensory receptor cells. Then it enters the scala, actually this chamber is called the scala tympani, and it gets into here, and then it leaves the cochlea. All right, so sound enters the oval window, goes through the cochlea, and comes back out via the, what's the shape of this window right here? Round. So here is the round window in the vestibule. If that sound energy got trapped in here, then it would fracture the cochlea. So there has to be a release for it. Okay, here is a better view of those chambers, right? The scala tympani is connected to the round window. The vestibuli is connected to the oval window. And this is the area that sound has to pass through, right, in order to be released through the round window. And when sound passes through this region, this thing right here that we call the tectorial membrane vibrates back and forth, up and down. And then that excites some receptor cells, right, that we call the organ of Corti. So here is the organ of Corti. Let's zoom into this region. So we zoomed right in. All right, here's that tectorial membrane. It can vibrate back and forth, and it's connected to these cilia that project from this cell that we call a hair cell. It's not that it grows hair, but it kind of, these cilia right here kind of reminded somebody of hair. All right, so when the tympanic membrane bends these cilia, that changes the electrical property of these hair cells, which then changes the electrical properties of this nerve, which takes information to the temporal lobe. And in your temporal lobes, you have areas, and that area looks very much like a piano as well. If you stimulate one end of it, you'll hear a high pitch. If you stimulate the other end of it, you'll hear a low frequency pitch, right? And that just matches up with the cochlea very nicely. All right, so what's the name of these cells that we need for hearing? These are the primary sensory cells for hearing. These are hair cells, right? And they have these cilia, or sometimes we call these stereocilia, that poke up into this tectorial membrane. That's for the sense of hearing. Oh, there's a nice electron micrograph. All right, this is how sound gets into the cochlea, right? Tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, auditory ossicles vibrate back and forth, vibrates the oval window, right, which then sends sound energy into the vestibuli, scala vestibuli, passes through the cochlear duct, exciting the organ of Corti at some particular location. Then it enters the scala tympani, and it leaves via right here. What would be right here if we're going to draw it in? Maybe I can see it a little bit. That's the round window, right? The round window right here. Okay, so high frequencies, you hear very close to the oval window. Low frequencies penetrate deeper into the cochlea, and they're appreciated more over here at the end. This is what we call the helicotrema of the cochlea. That's for low frequency hearing. Okay, let's talk about equilibrium sense, and in particular the vestibule. So we've cut off the part that has the oval window, right, and we're no longer interested in sound. And what gives us a sense of head position is the following structure over here. Right, this is what we call a maculae, and there are two of them. Right, there is a utricle and a saccule. Here's the utricle, here's the saccule. And here is a gelatinous mass. Kind of reminds me of that tectorial membrane a little bit. And then sitting on top of it, can you see these things are crystals? These are calcium carbonate crystals. Can you see a nice little sharp point right here? These crystals are what we call otoliths. And the otoliths put a little weight on this otolithic membrane or gelatinous mass. And poking up into this gelatinous mass are some more stereocilia from cells, right, in the maculae that we call hair cells. And these hair cells have stereocilia on them. And when they bend one way, that changes the electrical properties of this nerve. And if they bend the other way, it changes the electrical properties in a different way, so that you can figure out what your head position is without even looking around the room, if this structure is working properly. All right, so what is something in common with the maculae, both of these maculae, the utricle and saccule, with the organ of Corti? Do you see anything similar? Does the organ of Corti have otoliths? Did you see any? I didn't mention any crystals. Okay. What about hair cells? Did the organ of Corti have hair cells? You're going to have to go back and look at that. And you will notice that it does, right? In the organ of Corti, these hair cells touch the tectorial membrane, but in the utricle and saccule, these stereocilia touch this, what we call the otolithic membrane, with these crystals on top of it. All right, so how does this work? With your head straight up, right, these crystals push straight down on the stereocilia, and they don't bend. Right? When you tilt your head forward, then this gelatinous mass right here, and especially these crystals, pull that otolithic membrane down, and it bends these stereocilia. And even with your eyes closed, you can tell that your head is facing down. Right? Or if you go the other way, you can tell as well. So this sense of equilibrium is what we call static equilibrium. Static equilibrium. So maybe you write that down. Hopefully, is that on your slide somewhere? About static equilibrium, right? In the vestibule, because they contain maculae, and both the utricle and saccule are maculae. Okay, and static equilibrium is good for something we call linear acceleration. Gravity works on us like acceleration. That's why when we bend our head down, the stereocilia bend. Right? And also, if you're in a car and all of a sudden it starts to accelerate, right, forward, then these objects, the utricle and saccule, will also help you maintain balance. Okay, but not spinning, just linear acceleration. And who can tell me, acceleration is kind of a fancy term. What does acceleration mean? Anybody have a sense of what acceleration is? It's different than velocity. What is velocity? Velocity is a speed that you're moving at, like a distance per time. Miles per hour is a speed, okay? But acceleration is when you change velocity, right? When you go from maybe 2 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour, that's acceleration, okay? You guys know that's really fun. Or if you go from 100 miles an hour to 0 miles an hour, that's deceleration. That's not so much fun, right? Okay, so, and that's linear acceleration from the utricle and saccule. Okay, there are other organs, right? In these semicircular canals, and there's fluid in these semicircular canals, right? And that fluid can flow in a nice circle. The semicircular canals are important for what we call angular acceleration, right? Not linear, but angular. Another way of saying angular is spinning, right? So spinning is a different kind of motion from just when you're moving in a linear direction. But again, it's acceleration. If you're spinning at a constant rate, these things won't help you, right? But if you're standing still and then start to spin, right, then you're accelerating, then the semicircular canals will help maintain balance for you. Or deceleration. Well, at the base of a semicircular canal, there is an ampule, which is a little bulge in the semicircular canal that reminded somebody of a little glass vial that medication is put in sometimes, right? Just a little ampule. And the organ for spinning is in the ampule, and so it's called the crista ampullaris. And if we zoom into this region, this is what the crista ampullaris looks like. All right, so the crista ampullaris is the organ for angular acceleration. Sometimes we call that kinetic equilibrium. Right? Write that down. Kinetic equilibrium. I'm not sure I know what your book calls it, right? If they call it angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium. Oh, your notes right here say kinetic equilibrium. That's really good. Okay, so again, there is a gelatinous mass that is called the cupula. And there are stereocilia that poke up into the cupula, and these stereocilia come from, originate from, look at these cells over here. What do we call these cells? These cells are called hair cells, right? Because these stereocilia reminded somebody of hair, right? And when you, there is fluid in the semicircular canal, which is a mass. Mass has a property of inertia. And inertia just says that if you're stationary, that mass likes to remain stationary, right? Or if that mass is in motion, then it likes to continue in that same kind of motion. It doesn't like to change, doesn't like to decelerate or change direction. That's what inertia means. So there is fluid, which is endolymph in the semicircular canals. If you start to spin, right, this bony labyrinth is connected to your temporal bone, so it's going to start to spin immediately. So the crista ampullaris is going to start to spin, but the fluid in the semicircular canals is going to remain stationary because it's not tightly connected to anything. And if the crista ampullaris starts to spin but the endolymph doesn't, then the endolymph is going to push on the crista ampullaris and bend the stereocilia, which will change the electrical property of the hair cell, which changes the electrical property of this nerve, which brings information to the brain about spinning. Okay. And then the opposite can take place too. And I'm sure you maybe did this yesterday, right? If you spin for a long period of time and then stop all of a sudden and look around, you'll see the world do what? In front of your very eyes. then the world looks like it's spinning, even though your eye, even though you're not spinning anymore. And that's because after you spin for a long period of time, then the endolymph starts to spin with you. And then if you stop, all of a sudden the crista ampullaris stops, but what about the endolymph? It is still spinning. And it pushes the crista ampullaris or the stereocilia in the opposite direction, right? And then that will give you an inappropriate sense of spinning because the endolymph is still moving. All right, so those are the two senses, right? Static equilibrium for linear acceleration. Kinetic equilibrium for what kind of acceleration? Angular acceleration, or different. You know, it's different than linear acceleration because of that. Okay, so those are the major senses. There's a couple of questions at the end of the chapter, maybe some online questions that talk about that, kinetic equilibrium, static equilibrium from the vestibule. All right, so what are the three main areas of the inner ear? What are the three main areas? And therefore, the three main senses that we talked about. The three main parts are the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. And the cochlea is responsible for what sense? Hearing. Nice. And the vestibule is responsible for what sense? Linear acceleration or static equilibrium. And the semicircular canals are responsible for angular acceleration, or sometimes we call that kinetic equilibrium. Just kind of fancy words, but I like spinning and linear acceleration or angular acceleration a lot. All right, so you've probably looked at all these things in lab and now you know a little bit more about them. And the sense of equilibrium, you need the inner ear, but you don't need the middle ear. What sense do you need the middle ear for? Remember, there's three senses. You got hearing, static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium. Which one of those senses do you need the middle ear for? For hearing, because those bones have to vibrate back and forth, right? Those auditory ossicles have to vibrate back and forth. And that those are in the middle ear, like the stapes is in the middle ear. So middle ear is necessary for hearing, but not for any of the equilibrium senses, right? And what about the external ear? Is there any of those three senses that you require an external ear? What happens if you take a cotton ball and stick it in your external acoustic meatus? What will happen to your... You can't hear. That's right. So the external ear is important for hearing, but it plays no role whatsoever for the equilibrium senses, whether it's static equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium. Okay, so that's it for senses. Unless I see a question. Anybody have a question? Okay, I'll put those away. And we're going to go to endocrine system. Okay, endocrine system, where's endocrine system? Here's endocrine system. Let's get some pictures up here. This might be an exam figure. I'm not sure. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure? Maybe. Okay, well, here's just an outline of a human, and there are some organs inside this human, and in particular, these organs are what we call endocrine glands. Right? And you know something about glands. You know two major kinds of glands. Who knows the major? There's two major kinds of glands. Can anybody break all glands in your body into these two kinds? Endocrine is one. Exocrine is the other, right? So, and what's the big difference? An exocrine gland or exocrine gland has a duct, and an endocrine gland has no duct. They both synthesize a product. They both secrete it outside of the gland. But if it's an exocrine gland, then that product gets captured by a duct and then it's carried to where it's supposed to have its activity. Like the digestive enzymes made by the pancreas, right, are secreted into a duct, so those digestive enzymes don't digest the pancreas down. The duct carries it to the small intestine where they do their work. Right, that's an example of an exocrine gland. The pancreas, which I see right here, is also an endocrine gland. It has other cells that produce a compound and secrete it, but in this particular case, not into a duct, but into the blood. And then the blood carries that signal all over the body. And in particular, you're probably familiar with one of those, and it's called insulin. Right? Insulin comes from the pancreas, and just for fun, does anybody know what insulin does for us? What does it do? It has something to do with sugar. What does it have to do with sugar? Okay. It's secreted when blood sugar is high, right? Insulin then lowers blood sugar, and the reason why it lowers blood sugar is because insulin acts as a passport so that sugar can enter cells. Without insulin, sugar is trapped in the blood, can't enter your cells, and that's really sad when that happens because cells need glucose, just like your car needs gasoline, right? That's an energy source for those cells. So cells are kind of starving to death if they can't get sugar inside them. And insulin is necessary for that to happen in most cells of your body. All right, so an endocrine gland secretes a compound that we call a hormone. Okay, a hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland, goes into the blood, travels wherever the blood goes, and it diffuses out of the blood, and then it can affect the physiology of some cells at some distant location to the gland that secreted it. All right, and we're going to call that a target tissue. A target tissue has to have something in order to recognize that hormone that's floating around in your body. And I don't see it on this slide over here, but I think maybe you kind of know. All right, how a stimulus always starts a response loop. What can detect a stimulus in your body? Can you remember what a reflex or a response loop? Remember, a response loop always starts with a stimulus and ends in a response. What can detect a stimulus? It is a receptor. That's right. So a target tissue is a target tissue if it has a receptor for that particular signaling chemical that we call a hormone, and that's in the blood. Okay. If there is a tissue that doesn't have that receptor, then it will have no idea if that hormone is floating by it at all, right? It just won't be able to tell. All right, so that's a good definition of a hormone, right? A hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland into the blood where it travels to some distant location and it binds to a receptor on a target tissue and it changes the physiology of that target tissue somehow or another. Okay, it produces a different kind of response in that target tissue. All right, so the endocrine system is important for regulating body processes, but not quickly like the nervous system, but in the long term, like from week to week or month to month. And because it regulates things in the long term, it has a much longer duration. Once a hormone is secreted into your blood, right, it will have an effect on your body for a much longer period of time compared to the nervous system. All right, so what are some of the functions of the endocrine system? Right, it regulates relatively slow processes because it takes a while for it to develop, but it will last a long time. Right, it's important for growth. Right, and is growth a long-term process? Well, yeah, it's years. Right, when you're just born, then you grow for years and years and years, decades, as a matter of fact. It also regulates metabolism, regulates the reproductive system. The very last chapter that we talk about, it regulates blood chemistry, and it even helps fight infections. And of course, when we fight infections, we want a long-term commitment from our immune system to fight infection, not just an instantaneous response. What are some of these endocrine glands or organs? Right, here is a list. I don't think I'm going to read the list, but let's look at the illustration over here. I see a pancreas, okay, and I see a gland on top of the kidneys. Here's a kidney. That's called an adrenal gland. And as a matter of fact, the kidneys are an endocrine gland all by themselves. Thymus gland, thyroid gland. These two little things in the thyroid gland are called parathyroid. And then there are some endocrine glands inside the brain, like the pineal and the hypothalamus. and the pituitary gland. These are endocrine glands. So if the pituitary is an endocrine gland, what does it secrete? A hormone. Yeah, really good. Okay. All right, here are a couple. You either have one or the other. These are what we call gonads. And males have testes, females have ovaries. And the job of these gonads are to produce something that we call sex cells or gametes. Right? And a sex cell and a gamete has half the number of chromosomes compared to all of the other cells inside your body. They get there by a special process called meiosis. And that makes perfect sense because that gamete that's produced by the testes is called a sperm. And that gamete that's produced by an ovary is called an egg, right? And it's the job of sperm and egg to unite. What do we call that process? Fertilization, right? And if each of those cells have half the number of usual chromosomes, when they join together, what does that cell have? The exact number of chromosomes that a human cell should have, right? Okay, so that's produced by the gonads, but the gonads don't just produce reproductive cells or sex cells, they also produce sex hormones and secrete sex hormones like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. Males only have testosterone, females have estrogen, progesterone, and a little bit of testosterone. Okay, so guys are really left out on that score, and you ladies should be a little sensitive to that. Okay? Okay. Okay, so some others. The heart secretes a hormone. Digestive tract secretes hormones. I mentioned the kidneys and even the skin secretes some hormones. And these all go into the blood and regulate processes at some distant location if that is a target tissue because it has a receptor. Most of these endocrine glands are from epithelium, okay, but some maybe are derived from neurons, like for instance in the hypothalamus, right, muscle cells and a few other cells, but mostly, gland cells come from epithelial origin. Okay, what about some classes of hormones? Okay. Here's a pretty nice slide. I bet this is an exam figure because I see a bunch of question marks all over the place. All right, so here is the real figure. And I see three different modes of action. Okay, and so this is what we call control of hormone secretion. So these are all endocrine glands. I see parathyroid glands embedded in the thyroid gland. I see the adrenal medulla, and I see the adrenal cortex. Remember, cortex is a superficial part of any organ. Medulla is the deep part. Right? And so we're going to probably look at both of these sooner or later. And then here, what do we have? Adrenal cortex, thyroid gland, oh, and a gonad. Okay. So there are different ways that these endocrine glands are controlled and told to secrete something into the blood. All right, for instance, humoral. Humoral just means that there is a chemical floating around in the blood, or a humor, and this particular humor is going to be calcium. That's what this Ca stands for. This is an ion, and you know calcium ions are important for strong bones, for synaptic transmission, for muscle contraction, right? So blood calcium levels are very, very important. The parathyroid glands help regulate calcium in the blood so it's at a proper level. All right. And when calcium starts to decrease in the blood, these parathyroid glands can measure that, right, because that calcium is a humor, and then the parathyroid glands release parathyroid hormone, which acts in a couple different ways. It goes to bone, so that bones start to demineralize, and then those minerals are put in the blood. It goes to the kidneys so that you resorb more calcium from urine before you lose it from your body. And it also goes to the digestive tract to help you absorb more calcium from your diet. And all those three have a tendency to increase blood calcium levels. That comes from parathyroid hormone from the parathyroid glands, right, on either side of the thyroid gland in your neck. All right, so that's humoral. Responding to chemicals that are in the blood. Neuronal. Here is spinal cord, right? So here's a cell body in that lateral horn. It leaves this root, and this is what we call the ventral root. So what kind of neurons do we have right here in the ventral root? It's going to be 100% one kind or the other. Okay? So it could either be sensory or it could be motor, right? It could be afferent or efferent. And in the ventral root, this is always a motor, right? So ventral is motor, dorsal over here is for sensory or afferent information. All right, so here we have nerve impulses leaving. That's the definition of efferent or a motor neuron. And it goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, and then it signals the adrenal medulla to release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. And then epinephrine goes everywhere and signals other kinds of cells. So, but what's causing the release of epinephrine from the adrenal medulla is a neuron or a nerve signal. And that's why we call that neural stimulus as opposed to humoral, when there is just a chemical in the blood like calcium. And then the last kind is hormonal. This is very common, right? And instead of using a nerve signal or a chemical signal, it uses another hormone to cause the secretion of a second or third kind of hormone. So let's take a look at that. Here is the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus can secrete a hormone that goes into the blood that goes to the anterior pituitary. And then that causes the anterior pituitary to release other kinds of hormones. All right, so the cells of the anterior pituitary are controlled by hormones from the hypothalamus, and we call that hormonal control, right? It doesn't have to do with nerves, doesn't have to do with chemicals in the blood, but just due to hormones from the hypothalamus. And then these cells of the anterior pituitary can furthermore stimulate the thyroid gland if it's a thyroid-stimulating hormone, or the adrenal cortex, or these gonads. And we'll look at some of those hormones in just a little bit. But does anybody have a question on these three different modes of controlling hormone secretion in endocrine glands? You all are pretty good with that? Okay. Okay, let's look at the pituitary gland. It secretes 9 major hormones. It's attached to the hypothalamus. Right. Ah, nice. All right, so here's thalamus, this egg-shaped structure. Here's the hypothalamus down below it. Right. And on either side of the walls of this hypothalamus, or right smack in the middle, that's the third ventricle. And the hypothalamus is connected to the pituitary gland. Sometimes we call the pituitary gland the hypophysis, and pituitary are the same thing. When you look at the pituitary, does it look like one structure, or does it look like a couple or many, or how many things do you see here? You see two. That's right. There's an anterior part and a posterior part. And we're going to look at those separate from each other. Nonetheless, both the anterior and posterior are controlled by the hypothalamus, sometimes by hormones and then sometimes also just by electrical stimulus from a neuron. Okay, two basic divisions, anterior lobe, posterior lobe. This anterior lobe comes from epithelium, and so we call this the adenohypophysis. Remember, hypophysis is pituitary. Adeno always refers to glandular tissue, like an adenocarcinoma is cancer of some kind of gland someplace in your body. So adeno or anterior pituitary, I'm always going to refer to it as anterior pituitary. But this posterior part actually have axons from cell bodies in the hypothalamus that go through this connection into the posterior pituitary. And so it's only neuronal tissue, and that's why they call it the neurohypophysis. Okay, the neurohypophysis. This connection between the pituitary and the hypothalamus sometimes is called the stalk of the pituitary or the infundibulum. What did we have in the lab manual? Was it stalk or infundibulum? Yeah, infundibulum. All right, so here we can see it just a little bit. So that's a bridge, right? This infundibulum is a bridge between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. There was another name for bridge that we used when we looked at the central nervous system. What was another name? Peduncle, yeah. Most of the, like here, right? So here's the fourth ventricle. Here's the cerebral peduncle. That's a bridge between the cerebrum and the brainstem. This infundibulum, you could consider a peduncle, not nearly as big as the cerebral peduncle. So sometimes I think of it as a peduncolito, just a tiny, tiny little peduncle right here. Okay, but it's a bridge between the hypothalamus and pituitary gland. Okay, how does this work? Well, I see the anterior and posterior pituitary, and then I see the infundibulum once again. All right, let's look at this slide right here. And we're going to consider only the anterior pituitary. Okay. All right, so there are neurons in the hypothalamus that move over to the top of the infundibulum and secrete substances that are hormones because they get picked up by a capillary right here at the base of the hypothalamus. So they're in the blood, and then they move through this blood vessel to a second capillary that's in the anterior pituitary, and they diffuse out of the blood and move around everywhere in the anterior pituitary, causing the cells of the anterior pituitary to release other hormones. Those other hormones are called thyroid-stimulating hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone. Well, thyroid-stimulating hormone goes to the thyroid gland. FSH and LH go to the gonads, so they're important in reproductive function. ACTH goes to the adrenal cortex, so we call this adrenal corticotropin hormone. All of these are tropic hormones, which mean that these are necessary for these other glands to be healthy, to grow and maintain their shape, their size, and their secretory function. All right, so without thyroid-stimulating hormone, the thyroid gland is going to regress. It's going to dissolve away, and it won't secrete any hormones. Without ACTH, the adrenal cortex is going to shrink away. Without FSH and LH, the gonads are going to shrivel up because they're trophic hormones. Okay, and then we also have growth hormone and prolactin from the anterior pituitary. So how do these signaling compounds from the hypothalamus get into the anterior pituitary? Via these blood vessels, and we call this the hypophyseal portal vein. Hypophyseal portal vein is how signaling compounds from the hypothalamus get into the anterior pituitary. And usually in our circulation, right, blood starts at the heart, goes to a capillary, and it returns to the heart. That's the usual circulation. But here in a portal circulation, there are two capillary beds back to back. There's the heart taking blood to a capillary, and it doesn't go back to the heart right away, but it goes through another blood vessel to a second capillary, and then it goes back to the heart. That's what we call a portal blood vessel. We'll look at a couple of those in this class, but here is a really good example. And what the heck is that portal system? It's a door-to-door delivery system for hormones from the hypothalamus going to the anterior pituitary. All right, so that's the job. All right, what about the posterior pituitary? Here I see some cell bodies in the hypothalamus. What do we call gray areas in the central nervous system? Gray areas meaning nerve cell bodies and dendrites. A group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system is called a? Okay, in the peripheral nervous system it's called a ganglion. In the central it's called a nucleus, except your book uses some really old terminology for like the basal ganglia. They're really nuclei. If it was a really nice modern book, they would change that to basal nuclei. So here are some nuclei. Supraoptic nucleus, that just means what? Right above the optic chiasma. Here's that optic chiasma, that's what that means. So here are the cell bodies, and then here are the axons. Move all the way down into the posterior pituitary through the stalk. And what do we call myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system? Not peripheral nervous system, but central nervous system. A group of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system is called a tract. That's right. So here's a tract from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary. And since it starts in the hypothalamus and ends in the pituitary, we call it the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, right? Hypothalamo, just from the hypothalamus. Hypophyseal, just is another name for pituitary gland. Right, so from to, it's a tract. There's no blood vessel. There's no portal blood vessel like for the anterior pituitary. Now, the posterior pituitary, there's only two hormones that are secreted. And they're secreted directly from these neurons. Right? And usually we think of a compound secreted by a neuron as a neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, since it gets picked up by the blood, it's acting more like a hormone. Even though it's secreted like a neurotransmitter, it's transported in the body as a hormone. Right? So oxytocin and ADH, which is another name for antidiuretic hormone, are really what we call neurohormones. Here is an interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system, where they are controlled together. And in a lot of classes, we don't talk about the nervous system by itself. We don't talk about the endocrine system by itself. There's a chapter that's called the neuroendocrine system because they function together to control things, processes in your body. All right, so antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. An antidiuretic will reduce the amount of urine that you form, will help you conserve water inside your body. Right? So it's, ADH will produce a very small volume of urine that's very concentrated in salt. That's what antidiuretic hormone does. And the important reason for that is because it helps regulate blood pressure. When you retain fluids, your blood pressure will be maintained or increase. Right? And probably a really good way to think of that is your car tire. If your car tire is flat and you want to increase the pressure of that car tire, do you take air out or do you put air in to make the pressure in your tire greater? You put air in. Same thing for blood pressure. If you put fluid into your cardiovascular system, your blood pressure will increase. If you take fluid out, your blood pressure will decrease. All right, that's the job of antidiuretic hormone. Oxytocin, on the other hand, is a powerful smooth muscle stimulant. And it causes smooth muscle to contract. Not all smooth muscle, but especially smooth muscle in the uterus. So it's important for parturition. This is a signal for uterine contractions during parturition. And also smooth muscle of the glandular tissue of the breast. All right, so oxytocin is released when an infant is nursing. And oxytocin goes to the breast and it causes smooth muscle to contract to eject milk. And then the infant is interested and starts to nurse and starts to suckle more. And that tactile information goes back to the hypothalamus, right? Now the hypothalamus knows that there's an infant nursing on the breast, which then causes more release of oxytocin, which causes more milk letdown. And then the infant is more interested, right? And that produces more tactile information to the hypothalamus, which causes more oxytocin release, which causes more milk letdown. That's what we call a positive feedback mechanism, right? If there's an increase in oxytocin, then there is an increase in milk letdown, which stimulates the hypothalamus because the infant is providing tactile information on the nipple. Okay, so how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin or breast milk? If this is a positive feedback, right? If oxytocin causes release of milk, and that release of milk causes more release of oxytocin, which causes more milk letdown, which causes more oxytocin to be released, how come the whole universe isn't filled with breast milk? And that's because a breast can only produce a certain, a finite amount of milk, right? And then the breast can't let down any more milk, and then what happens to the infant when there's no milk on the breast? They fall asleep. Okay, and then the breast builds back that milk and the cycle starts again. So positive feedback mechanisms can be natural. There's only a couple of them in life. That's one of them, but there's something that has to stop that from happening. And in this particular case, the breast just runs out of milk. Okay? Oxytocin is also involved with parturition. There's another positive feedback mechanism working there that we'll talk about when we get into the reproductive chapter. Okay, so oxytocin, when administered in a hospital, it's not called oxytocin. Does anybody know the pharmaceutical grade oxytocin, the name of it? It is called Pertocin, right? Is that what somebody said? Oxycontin is an analgesic that's for anesthesia or, okay, so not for milk letdown, as far as I know, okay? Okay, I've never known any nursing mothers on OxyContin to know, okay? Okay. Probably not a really good idea because what is the baby going to get then? OxyContin, that's not a good thing, Okay, yeah. All right, so that's the pituitary. You've got an anterior part, posterior part, hypothalamus controls both, okay, but through different mechanisms. The posterior via nerves directly, a tract, but the anterior via that portal blood vessel, okay, coming from the hypothalamus down into the anterior pituitary gland. Okay. So here's just a little description of some of those different hormones. Gonadotropins, the gonadotropins, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, we call gonadotropins because they make what part of your body grow and secrete hormones and produce other things? Your gonads, right? So FSH and LH will cause ovaries and testes to produce gametes like sperm and eggs, and also to secrete various hormones like testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, and it also helps control ovulation as well. Okay. Okay. Thyroid gland, located in your neck. So here's a thyroid gland. Here is your Adam's apple. It kind of sticks out a little bit. Right underneath it, there is something that looks like a butterfly. It's really narrow in the front, and it has some lobes on either side. That's the thyroid gland. And if you look inside the thyroid gland, it has all of these circular structures that we call follicles. And these follicles produce thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone will only work if it has an iodine element bound to it. So it's a hormone, but it has to have iodine. Thyroid gland can produce that hormone without iodine, but then it won't have any ability to control different things in your body. Right, so your body won't be stimulated by the thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone sometimes is called T3 or T4 based on the number of iodine atoms it has bound to it. T3 has 3 and T4 has 4. Okay? And they have different names as well. But T3 and T4 work just fine. Okay? They come from the thyroid gland that help regulate growth and development, but also help regulate metabolism in your body. All right, we talked about the parathyroid glands. They're on the posterior side of the thyroid gland. Okay, here are those parathyroid glands involved with regulating blood calcium levels. When blood calcium decreases, parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. Right, it goes the other way. By dissolving bones, by helping absorb calcium from your diet, and helps prevent loss of calcium in the production of urine. Okay, adrenal glands. Here is a kidney. All right, well, here's your belly button. This is a good place to start. Here's your belly button. A little bit above your belly button and way in the back are your kidneys. And sitting on top of the kidneys are the adrenal glands. Right? And so here is an adrenal gland, and there are two main parts to it. There's a superficial part. What do we call the superficial part of any organ? Cortex. So here's the adrenal cortex. And then the deep part is the medulla. And we're going to be mostly interested in the cortex in this particular chapter. And you can see even the cortex has different layers to it. All right. Well, I think in the autonomic nervous system, we talked about the adrenal medulla already. When it receives an electrical impulse from the sympathetic nervous system, it releases epinephrine and norepinephrine, otherwise known as adrenaline and noradrenaline. But the adrenal cortex doesn't receive innervation. It has no nerves. It has a receptor for ACTH from the anterior pituitary. And ACTH, okay, there are two different kinds. ACTH causes the adrenal cortex to grow and secrete hormones. These hormones are either called mineralocorticoids or glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids help regulate sugar metabolism in your body, and mineralocorticoids help regulate some minerals in your body, and most importantly will be sodium. Not calcium, but sodium. Example of a mineralocorticoid would be aldosterone. It helps maintain blood pressure. It helps get sodium out of urine. And as you retain sodium, you're going to retain water in your body. As you retain water, your blood pressure goes up. Glucocorticoids, like cortisol, that's the main type. It helps your body deal with stressful situations, okay, by helping regulate sugar metabolism, which is an energy molecule in your body. Right? So ACTH goes to the adrenal cortex, and it helps the release of aldosterone and cortisone-type steroids. Okay, we don't want thyroid gland. Oh, okay. What's happening there? Okay. Yeah. Okay, pineal gland. Let me see if I have any slides for pineal gland. No, we looked at it in lab. Okay, here's the pineal gland, really close to the thalamus. And the thalamus is part of the diencephalon, and it secretes a compound called melatonin. And melatonin helps regulate various kinds of rhythms in our body, especially those rhythms associated with day and night cycles. Okay, we call those circadian rhythms. We also think that it helps regulate the onset of puberty or reproductive function. And when we come back, I think we just need to talk about the pancreas just a little bit. And that's it for endocrine chapter. Okay, this is the last chapter for the test in 2 weeks. Sign-in sheet is going around.